It's time for episode 7 of Pure Tokyo Scope. I'm Patrick Macias, the author of Tokyo Scope, the Japanese cult film companion.
And I'm Matt Ault, the author of Pure Invention, How Japan Made the Modern World. And together, we are very, very hot.
It's getting hot in here.
I don't mean like hot as in like sexy. I mean, although we are, but hot as in, man, Tokyo is going through a heat wave right now.
I can feel the heat coming off the street. This is the only story I think that matters globally right now. The only thing that really is of any concern should be Japan sweltering in its worst heat wave ever recorded. Yes.
It seems like a really localized thing, but it's actually part of a bigger phenomenon. The actual headline is, so Japan has a rainy season. The rainy season usually lasts from kind of mid-end of June to early July. This year, it ended like a week before the end of June. Like, it's the earliest that the rainy season has ever ended in Japan since it's been kind of recorded.
I think since the 1950s, I think like pre-Godzilla 1954, I think.
Yeah, which is, that's the beginning of history, right? I'm pretty sure. And this is by far the hottest it's ever been this early, and which means that it's going to be this hot through September. It makes you want to play Sly and the Family Stone's Hot Fun in the Summertime over and over and over again.
Temperatures of nearly 40 degrees Celsius or 104 degrees Fahrenheit were marked in some parts of Greater Tokyo, home to 37 million people, on the sixth day of a heat wave that began after the earliest end to the capital's rainy season in decades. That ain't good.
So the real interesting question is how this is going to affect like mask wearing. The government actually issued a statement, I guess you'd call it. It's not like a ruling, saying you can take your masks off outside. But in my experience, people really haven't been doing that at all. And you're still supposed to wear your masks on trains and like in buildings and things like that. But I would say there's still probably like 90% mask wearing on the streets, at least in my neighborhood.
And it hasn't really even peaked yet. I think they're talking about even higher temperatures this Sunday.
Before. Oh, it hasn't peaked. No way. No, like this, like August is traditionally the worst month for heat in Japan. And, you know, when people abroad tend to, in my experience, schedule their visits for kind of the mid-late summer. And I'm always like, guys, no, gals, please stop. Don't, you know, it's a really nasty time to be walking around outdoors, which made like the holding of the Olympics during the summer, the delayed Olympics during the summer a year ago, so insane.
What about the holding of the comic market every August?
God, the body odor emanating from that building is something that has to be experienced to be believed. I think there were
the
like
funk of 40,000 years.
The funk of 750,000 people in one room. I think that's what they clocked in 2020. Like the last full comic market they had, I think it was like 750,000 visitors over 4 days or something like that. It's really amazing.
So it's one thing just to say, woo, it's hot outside, I sure could use some ice cream. But this is like, the consequences here feel very real because the electricity grid was creaking on Thursday, and they were telling people to turn off all non-essential electricity. There was talk of rotating blackouts. It sounds like it was like narrowly averted.
It's true. I mean, we turned everything off here. It's you just opened the windows for a little bit. I'm actually somebody who doesn't like enjoy being in air conditioned spaces. I find it kind of uncomfortable. So I wish I could open the doors more, but it's so oppressive out there.
So the other long-term consequence people are beginning to worry about is how this might affect produce. Japan is a nation of farmers growing stuff in fields. And if there's no rain, gosh, I don't know how that's going to affect the bread baskets here.
I mean, everything got screwed up by the, you know, all sorts of things going on. Like even you know, the butterfly effect, like the conflict in the Ukraine, you know, Chinese supply shortages and stuff. So like food has been getting really expensive here too. It's an interesting time to be alive, is it not? It's a very stressful time everywhere, but also in Japan, which is unusual because Japan usually tends to be kind of a bubble unto itself. I think Tokyo certainly does. And now we're kind of, I think it's going to be increasingly difficult for people to deny things like climate change or, you know, globalization not particularly being a great thing with the kind of issues that we're all facing.
And to top it all off, Prime Minister Kishida is now calling for maximum nuclear power use to generate the power to power all those air conditioners.
Oh, I thought that was about like fighting a kaiju or something. Is it just about air conditioners?
It's never a good part in the kaiju movie where the prime minister is calling for maximum nuclear power.
Exactly. It sounds like a Shin Gojira kind of situation, doesn't it? It's fun to joke, but it actually is a really dangerous thing for a lot of people. So, and I seriously, even though it's, even with it being dangerous, it's just difficult to kind of labor under this and like live under this. So I'm hoping that the heat wave breaks soon.
Have you ever thought about those like construction worker, like air conditioned vests that they have?
Yes, those vests, like they're all puffy because they're like, there's a fan blowing in. I wonder if those things actually work to keep you cool. The construction workers all wear them, so I guess they do.
We should ask them. Also, I'm thinking about asking the neighbor to spray me with the hose that he uses to water his tomatoes.
Yeah, I'm going to have Hiroko put the sprinkler up out front so I can like frolic in it, you know, that kind of thing. For those not in the know, these vests that we're talking about, like construction workers here and like laborers of all kinds wear these. It's like a nylon vest with two fans built into it, like kind of flat fans, and they induct air from the outside. They blow into the vest and kind of inflate it a little bit and I guess make you feel cooler. I don't know that it actually cools you down. I mean, I guess so. It's probably like making sweat evaporate against your skin or whatever.
I mean, that's a good look. You got to admit, like a cold mask protecting you from COVID, a puffy inflatable air-conditioned vest. I mean, you're basically ready to rock and roll in Akihabara.
Well, it makes you look like Kin Nikuman or like, you know, like, remember those inflatable Hulk like arms that you could put on as a kid?
Those like inflatable sumo uniforms they wear in Charlie's Angels.
Exactly. That you wear on Japanese game shows. So just to wrap up, it is incredibly hot here in Tokyo. We are all sweating to the oldies, so to speak, and praying that it is going to get a little bit cooler sooner rather than later.
Like Fonzie cool, not like a cool Japan cool.
Not like Japan Freezes. Was that like a sequel to Japan Sinks? I want to produce that.
And with that, we will switch to a commercial and frolic along to our feature segment.
Warning, the following offer is for mature audiences only. Exciting, mysterious, intense, graphic, provocative, raw. This is no ordinary animation. This is the exotic, bizarre, and beautiful world of Japanese anime. And this is your invitation to enter with the modern classic, Akira. Critics say Akira makes Blade Runner look like Disney World. It's action-packed, the future of animation. Siskel and Ebert call it the video pick of the week. Akira is yours for only $4.95 with subscription when you order the Best of Japanese Animation Collection Series. With these state-of-the-art sci-fi classics, you will enter a world beyond imagination, a future out of control, and an experience you will never forget. Don't say we didn't warn you.
Call 1-800-414-4422 now to order Akira for only $4.95 plus $3.79 shipping and handling. Future volumes are $19.95 plus shipping. Mature audiences only.
How are you? Long time no see.
Good, man. I'm in San Francisco, or I'm in Marin right now, actually.
Is it as apocalyptic out there as I imagine?
Oh, my God. I mean, every day there's a new Supreme Court ruling. It's not just Roe versus Ray.
No, of course not. They're also banning anime, I believe.
I don't know.
But think of all the great punk rock we'll get.
You mean SoundCloud rap? I think isn't that the equivalent of punk rock today?
So this is our very first interview we've ever done here on the Pure Tokyo Scope podcast. And I figured what better way to begin a new era of audio entertainment than to bring on Mr. Vince Shortino, the founder of Crunchyroll Japan and the founder of a new company called Octas Inc. So welcome, Vince, to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So Vince, tell us about your background a little bit. Where did you come from? What planet? What solar system?
Yeah, I'm actually from the Midwest. I was born and raised in Kansas City, Missouri. I went to the University of Missouri, and it happened at the University of Missouri. This isn't like I went there, I graduated high school in 84. So it was at University of Missouri in 84. And then University of Missouri had an exchange program with Sophia University in Tokyo. And we had an exchange program, and I applied for that. And that's when I first went to Tokyo or Japan in 86, 87. I studied Japanese, and I started studying Japanese. And as you guys kind of know, it's like not an easy language to learn. I was supposed to only be there a year, and I ended up staying 3 years.
But what in the first place kind of pushed you towards learning Japanese and going towards Sophia? Because I mean, my understanding is you did not come in like me and Matt as like a crazy, rabid, foaming at the mouth otaku.
Not at all. I mean, I was like a pre-business major at the University of Missouri. And at the time in the mid 80s, like, you know, Japan was taking over the world, right? They're buying Rockefeller Center, and Toyota and Honda were taking off, and everybody had this intense interest in Japan, but nobody really knew about it. And I thought, well, this is something I should learn about and maybe learn the language. And I had some friends that had lived in Japan, and they were like, yeah, you can go over there as a poor student, you can teach English, and you can make a, you know, you can pay your way. And so I said, okay. And I applied for the program and just took off without knowing anything about Japan, without knowing the language at all. I just immersed myself. And that's how I came to Japan. But I didn't have a big interest in Japan like you guys did, probably. I was just sort of like, it was very, very newsworthy at the time. Like, everybody was talking about Japan at that time.
Yeah, in the 80s. I mean, when I first started studying Japanese in the late 80s, like, I was the only one in my class who was studying because of like manga and anime and stuff. It was, everybody else was doing it to get like a leg up on salarymen, you know, in the coming economic war against Japan.
Yeah, I figured if I could learn how to speak Japanese, I could do international business. And if I could do international business, that meant I could travel. So that's kind of why, you know, I was only 19, 20 years old. So that was sort of the reason I got into it. But then, you know, you come to Japan and it's like, wow, it's crazy, right? It's so interesting. And I kind of got stuck. So basically, half of my college days were in Japan. And then after I graduated from college, I thought, oh, I got to go and use my Japanese. So I got a job at Panasonic in like 89, 90. Yeah, so I was in Japan for a few years, and then I was back in the States with Panasonic. And then I moved to Sharp for a while in the U.S. And then I worked for a company called 3Com, and they sent me to Tokyo, to Japan. And so at that time, I was working the PC OEM business, selling like modem connectivity technology to the manufacturers in Japan. People like Toshiba, who had some of the original, you know, notebook computers. And so then I worked with Sony at the time. And then I got into, with 3Com, I started selling telco equipment. And that's when I found voice over IP. And then I thought, wow, voice over IP seems really complicated. There's a lot of equipment. And then all of a sudden Skype came along. And so I started working for them. And all this time I'm in Japan, working for 3Com and Skype. And then from there, I wanted to stay in the startup land. And so I started working for Crunchyroll. So I don't know. In total, I've lived in Japan about 25 years, or maybe a little bit more.
I mean, so as someone who's spent a lot of their professional career like in a room trying to do business deals with Japanese partners and creatives, I mean, how do you do that? Because I know it's not always easy. You have to bridge not only a language gap, but a culture gap a lot of the time.
Yeah, it's not easy. It takes a lot of footwork, and it's a lot of relationship building, you know. Just keep at it, keep meeting, like meet as many people as you can, talk to as many people as you can. And, you know, that's what I did. And just sort of figure it out as you go along.
Drink with as many people as you can.
Yeah, that's part of it. You know, socializing is definitely part of it. Yeah, just to get to know people and then figure out what they need and figure out the right, you know, the way to get in. But definitely a lot of, for me, in my case, definitely a lot of footwork, a lot of izakayas and, you know, having a few beers with the guys.
No communication
for sure. I mean, that no communication was one of the ways I, you know, learned how to speak Japanese.
Well, it's funny when I was studying Japanese in the college, I was like interning at a local company that did business with Japan. And like the guy there who was my mentor said, you got to learn golf. You got to learn golf. It's all about golfing. And that's not the case anymore. I was like, oh man, golf, really? Really? And I didn't get into it. And it turned out that I didn't need that. So
did you buy the pants? Were you looking at a pair of like plaid golf pants? Did it get that close?
Yeah, like Caddyshack. I was like, does miniature golf count? Like, I really like, you know, putt-putt golf. Does that count?
Anime industry is not so much golf oriented.
No. It's definitely more cigarettes, beer, and whiskey oriented is my feeling.
And more down to earth, you know, the izakayas and yakitori places. That's where everybody's hanging.
Well, out. Somebody recently, do you ever even actually wear a suit here? I've rarely worn a suit in any business situation in Japan. And it's because I work mainly in games and like comics and anime and stuff like that. Is that the case for you too?
Previously, when I was doing telco industry business, that's, you know, talking, meeting with, you know, and the big telephone companies, then I would wear a suit and a tie. But yeah, after I got into entertainment industry, nobody wears a suit and tie pretty much. I probably only wore a suit and tie like, I don't know, 3 or 4 times when I was at Crunchyroll. But that was always for like, you know, big events, year-end party.
Galas. Yes, exactly.
The launching of the SDF1 Mega Road.
Exactly. Wasn't the Macross supposed to have launched by now? I think so.
2012 or something like that?
Jeez, we missed it. We really missed it. But then again, Blade Runner happened a couple years ago too, so...
I mean, has working styles in Japan changed at all over the last 20 years? Like, as someone who spent so much time, like, in addition to wearing suits or not wearing suits, I mean, has it gotten easier? Has it gotten harder? Is there more money on the table?
I don't know, you know? I mean, I don't know. I was a salary man for a long time. So that culture is kind of going away, I think, in a bit, in some ways, but it's still there. One thing that's really surprising me now, though, that I'm really happy about, actually, is it's a feature of the pandemic, is that now it's not always required to do a face-to-face meeting. Tokyo, Japan, they're always 30, 40 minutes away from anybody. So you set up face-to-face meetings. They always last 1 hour, no more, no less, and pretty much. And you meet face-to-face. You don't call people, really. You can email, but you got to set up, mainly you set up a meeting and you go and talk to people. But now with the pandemic, you know, people are teleworking and they're okay to do Zoom and Skype or whatnot.
I never expected Japan to adopt, you know, work from home stuff. I don't think they would have without the pandemic.
They were forced to.
Yeah, but they adapted. It's really great. You know, to me, I think the biggest difference from when we were studying Japanese in the 80s to now work-wise is that, like, the idea that you're going to be working for a single company for your entire life has really, I mean, that already was breaking up in the 90s. And now I think people are pretty much in the gig economy sort of mindset. Even when they're working full time at a company, like, there's a much less resistance to moving to a different one. Don't you think?
I think so. But the big, like in the anime industry, when you work with the big TV stations, those guys are lifetime employees. But definitely in the anime industry, everybody's pretty much a freelancer. There's not a lot of employees at the studios, I would say. Most of the people working there are freelancing or, you know, temps. And they jump around to different projects and they chase around to I think the animators like to do the product. They get attracted by the product projects more than the money, which I think.
Well, I mean, you get into anime out of the love for it. I don't think anybody gets into it because they're like, I'm going to make $1 million. You know, yeah. Kind of thing.
That's what we got to change. We need to get some success stories because otherwise it's difficult for people to go into anime.
Exactly. But on a serious note, like, you know, Crunchyroll was the first really successful anime streaming service out there. When did you get involved with that? How did that all come to be?
It was actually, it's not just the first anime streaming service with subscription. It's actually one of the first subscription streaming services in the world. It was actually a few guys from Berkeley, and they had already built one company and sold it. And then their spare time, they were working at a company, in their spare time, they were building Crunchyroll, I believe. So it's kind of a long story. So I was working for Skype. I was actually with Skype in the very, very early days. And I was sort of like the country manager before Skype got big, really big, like right in the early days. Anyways, it quickly got bought by eBay. And then I was kind of intrigued with P2P technology at the time. So I took a job with a company called BitTorrent. People know what BitTorrent is, I think. And it was actually the guy who invented BitTorrent's company. And we had a P2P content delivery network solution. So I don't think people remember this, but back in the day, it was expensive to actually deliver video streaming over the internet. So
expensive for you or expensive for people to download it?
Expensive for the companies that are streaming, right? So using P2P, peer-to-peer, to kind of offload the network to people's PCs was a thing. And so BitTorrent actually had this P2P content delivery network solution. And one of their beta users happened to be Crunchyroll. And so I was working for BitTorrent at the time. And then my CEO of BitTorrent said, hey, these guys are going to come to Japan and I need you to like show them around. So I said, okay. And I didn't know really much about anime or entertainment business at all. So yeah, I took them around. And so that's sort of how I met these guys. And so we got some introductions to some of the big players in the streaming space, or not in the streaming space, in the anime space. And yeah, it was kind of crazy.
You know, anime wasn't a big thing in the mainstream back then at all. Like, it was still kind of niche.
Yeah, it was pretty niche. But at the time when I started at Crunchyroll, it was a top five search term on Yahoo. Naruto, Naruto itself was. And so then what was happening at that time was everybody was touring it. Everybody was illegally downloading their anime. They weren't really streaming it. They were downloading it and watching it. So people in Japan would, you know, it would air. I don't know, in prime time in Japan, like shows like Naruto and One Piece would air in prime time. Somebody would record it, put it up on a server, and then the world would download it. And, you know, there was fan subbers who would add subtitles to it. And then they would upload it to these torrent servers, basically. And people were downloading it all over the world. So there was a huge, huge piracy problem. We ran around and talked to lots and lots of people. I think it was 2007, summer of 2007. We were just like pounding the pavement, talking to everybody. And finally, so it worked in the sense that we were delivering the content to the world same day as it aired in Japan. It wasn't leaking before it was being aired, and kids around the world could see it. And that was great.
But I did want to talk about some of your highlights as a producer, producing anime like the Shelter music video for Porter Robinson. So how did you make this transition from like business licensing to like actual anime production?
We were just licensing for a long time, but we wanted to go upstream. So we did want to produce. And in parallel to that, I actually did a project after the tsunami, the big tsunami and earthquake disaster.
2011.
Fukushima. Yeah, that was crazy. In 2011. So somebody approached me who was friends with David Byrne, the Talking Heads, and he said, you know, he wanted to do something good for Japan, and he gave us a song, a previously unreleased song, and we made an anime music video. And so that project was, you can check out these videos on YouTube. There's a channel called Zapuni. That's my channel, Zapuni. But we did three videos for charity. One was with Urama Delvey, who's famous for bottom biting bugs.
Oh yeah, like the NHK, like kind of interstitial, those like short anime things that are really popular in Japan.
It was a big hit. Yeah, the Oshiri Kajirimushi song was a giant hit.
Yeah, and I'm friends with those guys. And so we made an anime music video that what the theme was the tsunami. And it's called Psychedelic Afternoon. And then we made another second video, another one where we licensed a song from Sigur Rós, and there's another video called Blossom. And what I found out from that is, like, man, when you marry like Western music, popular music, with anime artists, they come up with some really beautiful stuff. And then, so that was like my first foray into producing. And then somebody that worked at Crunchyroll had was friends with Porter, actually. And Porter's a big anime fan. And he came to us and said, hey, I want to make an anime music video. And I said, cool. Like, so we took on that project where he was basically funding it. He was the executive producer of the project, actually. And at the time, we were trying to produce. And so I thought this would be a really good experience for the team to do like this one-off project with Porter. So that we'd have interactions with the actual studio and learn how anime gets produced. And so we did that project. And then that anime music video turned out great. It has like 70 or 80 million views right now. It's called Shelter. So everybody needs to check it out.
Okay, Vince, tell us, what's a production committee? What is a production committee?
Yeah. So the way I usually explain it to people, and I know you know this stuff, Matt, but I always explain it to people that to think of every anime as a startup. So there's somebody who owns the original IP, and in anime, it's usually a publisher, right? And what do they want out of this? They want more books sold. They want to make more money off of that IP. So producers will go to the producers, say from like a TV Tokyo or Hakuhodo or Dentsu. Those are advertising companies, or you know, they'll go to TV Tokyo and they'll say, or they'll go to the publisher and say, hey, I want to make an anime out of your thing. And they say, okay, you can do that. we're not going to finance it, but we'll give you the IP, and then you can get a bunch of partners and you can create the anime. And so that person, the main producer is the production committee chairman, I guess. And they go around and they try to raise money, but they raise money from strategic partners. So there'll be a TV station will invest. There'll be somebody from the toy business, you know, maybe Bandai will invest, maybe somebody from gaming. And there's a bunch of different other companies who are going to take the rights and then monetize them. And the reason they're investing is to get the rights to go and monetize the property. So a typical anime, let's say the budget is $2 million to $3 million for 10 episodes. There might be 10 different partners that are involved. And each of those partners has an investment in it. And so they get a revenue share, a profit share. And then they also get some rights that they can go out and monetize and get a little bit higher profit share from the stuff that they monetize on their own. Did that make sense? So it's a startup with a bunch of strategic investments. It's like a startup. Each anime or anime property series or TV show is like a startup with a bunch of different investors. And they're industry players. They're always people
yes. who are always. So it's a consortium. It's a consortium. That's how I usually explain it. Like a consortium of different companies. And this is why you get in Japan that whole media mix thing where it's like, it's never just Gundam the anime. There's also the models and the books and the posters and the records, which was a big thing back in the 70s. And
yeah, music is always there's always a music label in the committee.
Yes.
So, I mean, I'm guessing the system has advantages and disadvantages. So if you wanted to talk about those.
Well, I guess the advantage is that they all have skin in the game, right? They're sharing risk. That's certainly a big advantage, right? So they share the risk. So they're hedging their bet, right? They also have incentive. If they're investing, they have incentive to monetize it. Right. To monetize the portion that they want, right?
Right, right,
so
right.
Bandai has incentive to monetize models, right? And you know, AVAX has a incentive to monetize a certain artist that they're trying to push, something like that. The TV station has incentive to, you know, air it on their TV station and sell ads against it so they can make money. So they all have, they're hedging their bets, they all have skin in the game, so they work hard, they try to work hard to monetize it and become a profitable, you know, operation.
That sounds great. There's no disadvantages.
Well, I mean, I know the disadvantage is that nobody will take action without consulting everybody else. So exactly. It's impossible. It's impossible to make decisions.
Yeah, that's you're right on. That's right on. I think that's the biggest disadvantage if it's a kind of a dysfunctional production committee. And
most of them are.
And a lot of them are. And then they don't make decisions very well. And so then, you know, the things don't move like they should, you know. But I think from going back to the anime music videos, I really feel like these kind of global collaborations done right can be really exciting and interesting.
Is that where you see yourself now? You're like a kind of global producer between, you know, Western and Japanese content?
I'd like to be. It's really, really difficult unless you're working for a giant company. But I'd like to do a couple things. One, I'd like to do these kind of global collaborations where particularly music, I think is a good fit for anime. Global collaborations, but also going more direct to the artists and the studios, because, you know, the studios, like you're kind of alluding to it a little bit ago, but it's all work for hire deals for them, right? Pretty much. So they don't make a lot of money, and they're pretty much told what to make by, you know, the big players in the production committees, the TV Tokyos, Fuji TV, and the publishers, right? And so they pretty much have to, they can't make their own IP. There's not a lot of original IP coming out of the studios. I think Shinkai Makoto, I don't know who else do we have these days?
Oh, like big names, you mean? Yeah.
Yeah, who make their own original anime.
Yeah, I mean, you'd say Studio Ghibli is basically shut down except for the occasional like Miyazaki Hayao thing. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting for like a medium that is so like creatively dynamic. There's very few, you know, breakout kind of solo big name stars. Like there's a lot of people working within the system who are extremely talented. But like you say, it's like Shinkai Makoto. You know, there's those Satoshi Kons, those like Miyazakis who are like, I'm going to go up myself.
They're few and far between. And there's a financial reason for that, right? They can't raise $2-3 million to make the story that they want. But I guarantee that they all have a story that they want. So that's what we need to change, I think. That's what I would love to see change a bit, because I think I mean, I talk to studios. I have a couple projects that I'm talking to directly to some anime studios, and they have really interesting ideas and they're really into it, right? So you know that when they put the heart behind it, it's going to be really cool. But they don't have a vehicle to raise the finance and, you know, and put the business parts together. And that's a bit of a shame. And, you know, moving forward, it'd be great if we had 10 Shinkai Makotos, right? Not one. And there's definitely 10 out there. It's just that, you know, it's a lot of work and it's difficult to nurture those kind of independent projects.
Well, do you think part of that is because it's just so difficult to like make a living in the anime industry? I mean, it's the conditions are notoriously harsh and the pay is notoriously low. You know, like It seems to me if you had talent in that vein, you'd want to go into the game industry instead.
Yeah, I mean, that's what everybody says, right? It's like you can make two or three times. As an animator, you can make two or three times as much if you work in gaming than you can in anime. And, you know, you're basically doing similar type of work, but it's for gaming industry. They pay a lot more.
We're in a world now where streaming anime is like firmly established. So, I mean, what do you think are the next big opportunities for the business?
Yeah, I mean, we're in a weird space right now because Crunchyroll and Funimation got bought by Sony Pictures, and so
it kind of $1 billion, did it not?
$1.2 billion. That's crazy. It's amazing. You know, that just shows you how strong anime is. It's pretty amazing. I think what we're going to see over the next 2-3 years is, you know, Amazon getting back in. You know, Amazon kind of dabbled in anime a little bit, and then they kind of pulled out. They had their own sort of subscription service for a second, and then they pulled out. But I think you'll see Amazon and Apple TV and Disney and these other streaming services start to jump back in, and hopefully there'll be more buyers, and that'll be important.
It's understood that anime is a kind of, it used to be seen as a genre, and now I think people are finally belatedly awakening up to the fact that it's a medium and you can kind of do whatever you want in it. That there's no specific limit on the genre that anime is.
I think anime is in a great space. I think it's going to continue to grow. More and more streaming services are going to jump on board. They can't ignore it. It's just too big. But I think we got to be careful to let I would love to see the anime studios be allowed to make their original works.
Right.
And experiment in that space, because I think you're going to get a much better product that way. Instead of going in and saying, you know, okay, let's make Ultraman again, or make Speed Racer again, or hey, why don't you make, you know, some, I don't know, Walking Dead, or something, you know, they'll bring in, instead of doing that, you know, it's better to get more Demon Slayers, right? That's what we want. That's what the fans want.
So basically what you're saying is, to go back to something you said earlier, what you're saying is the world needs anime.
The world definitely needs anime, yeah. Don't you think?
Patrick, does the world need anime?
Good ones, not bad ones. I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about your current company, Octas, of which you are also the founder.
So after I left Crunchyroll, I was like, okay, what do I do next? And I started my own company called Octas. And I have a lot. During my stay, my 9 years at Crunchyroll, I created a lot of relationships and connections in the industry. So I decided to stick around in the industry. And you know, my big goal was to try is still, and it's not quite there. It's not going to be there for a while, but I wanted to do a big global collaboration, you know, and make an original anime. That's difficult, but I'm still kind of trying. And I wanted to involve music. So that was sort of my goal original goal in launching Octas. But I also want to go artist direct. I want to cut out as many middlemen as possible, because there's way too many middlemen in this industry. And so I've been trying to do some artist direct work. So my big one that I'm working on right now is Gloomy Bear. So Gloomy Bear is 20 years old and it was relaunching. It was launching a short, an anime series. And so some friends came to me and said, hey, Vince, you want to manage Gloomy Bear in North America and Europe? And so I've been running that and it's going gangbusters. You can find Gloomy Bear at Spencer's and Hot Topic and Zoomies and other retail shops in the U.S. Now it's making a big comeback. So I'm working on that. I have another property called Mimi and Neko, which is a little bit nascent, but it's really cool Japanese like character IP. working on an NFT called VoxBot, which Matt kind of knows about a little bit.
Robots. Yes. No, thanks. Thanks for having me to visit the office space there. I have to say I'm not an NFT person. I don't own any. I don't aspire to, but I really thought that Oka Pro's designs, I mean, he's an amazing designer. The guy who's designing the robots for VoxBots. It's just amazing, amazing stuff.
Yeah. So I know there's like all that kind of, there's a little bit of controversy and some issues around NFT, but you know, our heart's in a good place here because as Matt's attesting to, Oka Pro is an amazing artist and, you know, the world needs to see his mecca, you know? And so like, we're going to try to do that. And it happens that the vehicle we're using at this stage is NFT. But you know, it's all NFTs aren't the same. And this is very cool and original. And we're trying to give people exposure directly to the artists. So this is an example of going direct, finding that needle in the haystack, these artists who've been around in the industry for a really long time.
Well, he's been doing like modeling for the model magazines for decades. I mean, right? Like Model Graphics, Hobby Japan, like basically whenever you buy an issue of Hobby Japan and see some insanely detailed Gundam model on the cover or a feature, it's his work, isn't it?
Yeah, he's writing the articles about it. He's explaining it. And a lot of times he's actually designing those models as well.
Yeah, Tamiya are one of those model companies. They put out an Oka Pro paint that's got a little SD caricature of him on the on the bottle.
Japan is so good at like cultivating that kind of connoisseurship and that kind of like craftspersonship. It's that's kind of key to the whole enterprise too, I think, of why everything, you know, from Japan has like kind of taken off around the world.
It's not just Oka Pro, you know, there's a lot of artists in the anime industry who are like him, right? Who are amazing artists. And they all have their idea and their thing that they want to make. Now we have to figure out how, you know, we finance them, right? And we tease out the next Your Name, the next Shinkai. And there's tons of them out there. There's lots of them out there. And so, you know, enabling these artists and these studios to make the original works is what I'm passionate about right now. And then licensing business is keeping the lights on for sure.
This is Shogun, the staggering saga of feudal Japan. The story of ruling warlords battling for ultimate supremacy. They are challenged by a stranger from across the seas, John Blackthorne, the one man with the power to change Japan's destiny for all time. This is the opening chapter of the six-part presentation starring Richard Chamberlain and Toshiro Mifune, the epic tale of power, passion, beauty, and tragedy. That is Shogun.
That was actually really cool. Our first interview ever and somebody so connected into the anime industry.
So look forward to more exciting interviews on the Pure Tokyo Scope podcast. Looking forward into the future. But in the meantime, please continue to listen and support our show. And if you have any questions or comments or anything you'd like to say to us, we're pretty easy to find on Twitter. And I think that's about it. We'll see you all next week.
See you next time.